Plot twists. We are obsessed with them. In film, life, and love, they turn up everywhere. It's that moment in a story that takes you in an unexpected direction. I'm Tom, super fan of cinema, sport, comedy, and I'm partial to the odd impression. And throughout this series, brought to you by Now and Sky, I'll be interviewing TV and film stars, asking them all about the plot twist moments that define their lives and careers. So expect the unexpected, and hopefully some behind-the-scenes gems you've never heard before. Expect spoilers. Hey, everybody. Very quick plot twist. I'm not in a studio. I'm in a hotel. So if you hear any trolleys or elevators beeping, bear with us. There's a bit of background ambience, but it's worth it. Now, the reason I'm in a hotel is that we're about to chat to an amazing comedian, Janine Aruni. And sometimes we'll get guests proposed to come on the podcast. And then you read about them, you hear about their story, their life, and you just think, I don't care what it takes. We've got to talk to them. And Janine is very much in that category. If you're a fan of comedy, you enjoy the comedy circuit here in the UK, or you've been to Edinburgh Fringe in recent years, you'll almost certainly know how great she is and her hit show, Manouche. She hails from Staten Island and moved to the UK over 10 years ago. The story behind that, I'm sure we'll delve into in the podcast itself, so I'll leave her to explain. But going back to Fringe, she made a statement last year where she performed a hit show, Manouche, whilst 8 months pregnant. Yeah, I know. It also didn't stop her getting nominated for Best Show either. It's quite extraordinary. It says a lot about her, and I'm sure that's something that we'll touch upon in the interview. That setup at Fringe whilst being pregnant, there's quite an emotional backstory to that, and no doubt that's something we'll touch upon in the interview. I'm sure she'll describe it much better than me, at least. Janine is pretty savvy on social media. A lot of her videos of her set have got millions and millions of views, and she also happens to be an actor, including the role of Carla Diaz in The Batman. You know, the Batman with R-Pats? That's pretty cool. There's so many things I want to talk to her about. I feel like after listening to this chat, she might be your new favourite comedian. I'm feeling it. Here is the amazing Janine Aruni on Plot Twist. Janine, we've got a lot to cover.
We do.
I thought the first thing would be nice to start with is, how's maternity as a comedian?
I think maternity, as anyone, is exhausting. It is so tiring, especially as the mom. I remember after the baby was born, I was like, it would be great if I just got two. I just went through childbirth and 9 months of pregnancy. It would be so great if I just got 2 weeks at a spa. But instead, they just give you a baby. And I have no experience with children. I'd never even changed a diaper before my son. And I remember thinking, if I was a nanny and I applied for a job as a nanny with my level of experience, I would never get hired, let alone be given a baby to take care of all the time. So what was the question? I'm exhausted.
That kind of answers it, right?
Yeah.
I kind of asked because you've been working quite a bit in that time. You've had a tour in January and Feb. Your boy's, what, 5 months?
Yeah.
So you've managed to fit a lot in between.
Yeah. You know. Don't do it. If anyone's thinking about doing it, take a break. Don't go on tour after you've had a baby.
Were these pre-existing commitments that have just...
I'll be honest. I was so smug. Me and my husband were both so smug when we were pregnant. We just thought, oh, people who have babies make such a big deal. It's a baby. You know, how hard can it be? And now that we have a baby, we're like, it is way harder than anyone ever described it to us. We took the baby on tour last week. We brought like a little pop-up kind of tent travel cot thing. He was sleeping in the dressing room. My husband would open for me. Then we'd have an interval. We'd swap over. He'd be in the dressing room with the baby. I'd go on stage. We'd do the show. Then we'd go and sleep in a hotel. Then we'd drive to the next place with the baby.
What a team.
I mean, it took a lot of couples therapy to get through that.
Can only imagine.
Yeah.
I've got some friends that are at different stages. One is about a month in. And then getting up to a year, obviously very different in terms of that progress.
But
it's, you can see how full on it is. So for you to do that with shows, and you're going to India next month
as well?
Going
to India, yeah, for 4 days, which is not enough days.
Why?
I don't know. They asked me to go. They asked me to go and do the show there. And I think there's probably a part of me that is very worried about slowing down. And so I think what I've done is just accelerated when I really should have just sort of had a bit more of a balance. But I am looking forward to it. You know, in this job, you can't really say, you can't turn work down, I think. And maybe that comes from, like, you know, being an out of work actor for so long and struggling to make any money. So now I sort of just say yes to everything.
You were in The Batman.
I was.
Is it Carla?
I played a character named Carla who had, let's be honest, 5 lines in the movie, maybe maximum 6.
Still pretty cool.
But I got a name.
Yeah. What would your superpower be?
I would love to speak every language.
Oh, yeah.
I think that would be a really cool superpower.
You know when people like bitching about you in another language?
Oh my God. Yes. And then
you could just
turn around and suddenly speak Mandarin. You know, yeah, that'd be great.
Cool.
I'd love that.
That'd be pretty cool.
I've tried. Sometimes if I think someone's speaking about me in another country, like on the train or something, I pretend that I know what they're saying. Don't. And they're probably not talking about me.
Raise an eyebrow.
Yeah.
Before we come onto the plot twist, I thought actually to set a bit of background, tell me about your grandmother.
Yes. The new show that I'm touring talks a lot about my grandmother. She was a classical Arabic singer. Have you seen the show?
I haven't seen the show.
Oh, okay. So this would be new. So yeah, so she was a classical Arabic singer and she started her career singing with Fairuz, who's a very famous singer in the Middle East. And they started as teenagers together. And Fairuz was actually my grandmother's backing singer. But you would only know that if you talked to my grandmother for more than 1 minute. And and Fairuz stayed in the Middle East. My grandmother left and moved to America. And Fairuz obviously became, you know, the most beloved singer of the Arab world. And my grandmother lived in Brooklyn and had a very different life. So the show kind of talks about the choices that you make when you have kids and end a career.
Why did she go to the US? What was the thinking behind the decision?
I think it was to have, you know, she would have more opportunity there for her kids, I guess, you know, Lebanon. I guess she moved in the 50s and then, well, the 70s, the war broke out in Lebanon, 1970. So, yeah, I don't know. She didn't leave because of the war, but yeah, I guess she'd grown up in extreme. Yeah, I think so. She grew up in pretty extreme poverty herself. I think she only had like a grade 3 education. Is that 7 years old?
Yes, I think
third grade,
so. Yeah,
we call it in America.
Yeah.
So she kind of sang to support her whole family. She was the oldest of 7 kids. And I think she moved to America to make sure that her kids had a very different life than she had when she was growing up.
Did she perform in the US?
She did, yeah. She performed a lot in Mexico, actually. So she would fly out and do performances all over the States and all over South America specifically, because there's a huge Lebanese population. I mean, more Lebanese people live outside of Lebanon. Lebanon's tiny. It's like the size of Brooklyn, I think. So more Lebanese people live outside of Lebanon than in. And so she would sing, you know, throughout the Arab diaspora in little parts of the world that had Lebanese communities. She'd sing at private parties of, I think, very wealthy people.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah. When she died, I know nothing about fashion, and she was a very fashionable woman. And when she died, we donated a lot of her clothes to this women's charity. So it was to help women who are trying to escape abusive relationships. And I didn't realize, but we had donated like Hermes scarves and like very expensive things that I think were all gifts that she got for performing.
Oh, wow.
And we just were like, what are we going to do with a silk scarf? This is weird. And actually, they're all worth like $2,000 or something crazy. we Googled it afterwards.
I should have kept that.
Yeah. But I guess
no, it's a good cause.
Good gift. Yeah.
Yeah. Plot twist. Should we do the first one?
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
The ultimate plot twist in your story.
Yes.
So an unexpected moment that has changed your narrative.
I think there's 2 big ones, but the first one for me would be when I was 21, a month after my 21st birthday, I was hit by a car and pinned inside the car. And when they cut the car off of me, I got rushed to the hospital and, among many injuries, found out that my right leg was paralyzed from the knee down. So that kind of really changed the course of my life, because I think it took me almost 3 years to recover from that. And I think afterwards, I had felt like I'd lost 3 years of my life. So I felt like I needed to catch up and leave New York. I think I'd been on a plane maybe twice in my life. You know, I grew up in a very working class neighborhood, like very blue collar. And that set me on a course of traveling. I think I traveled around Central America and then Europe and then decided to move to the UK and go to drama school here. So I was very sheltered growing up. You know, I had a curfew until I was 21 years old. And after being bedbound and housebound for so long, I realized I really wanted to get out and see the world and, you know, experience things I'd never done before. And I think that's why I live here. Plot twist.
That's a huge plot twist.
Is it?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, you broke your pelvis.
Yeah. So you knew, so it was not a surprise to you.
I knew about the crack. Yeah, I did know about it. I mean, do you remember much about it at the time? I mean...
Yeah, loads. Yeah, I wrote a whole show about it. Yeah.
It's pretty traumatic, really.
It's funny how when traumatic things happen in your life, you really quickly normalize it. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do, actually.
And I think it's a coping mechanism. I think it helps people get through it because 10 years after the accident, I wrote a show about the accident. And when I looked back at all the stuff, like my dad took loads of photos and videos and I read things I'd written at the time, I couldn't believe it had happened to me because I just felt like, oh, that's really upsetting. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a really tough thing to go through. But at the time, I think I was so focused on just getting better, recovering. You know, you just look at the day to day. I think my hand was paralyzed for a little while. So I remember they were just these small goals I had to achieve every day. We used like salad tongs in my occupational therapy because I lived in the hospital for two months I had to use the salad tongs to pick up a cube and put it inside a bowl. And that took a month to learn how to do. And that was just every day I wake up and that was my goal. You know, so I think you don't take in the full breadth of the experience that you're going through because it would be very overwhelming. Yeah.
I wonder, how long would you have stayed in New York if it hadn't have happened?
I don't think I would have left, probably. You know, people always ask me, how come I do comedy in the UK when I'm from the sort of comedy capital of the world, stand-up comedy capital of the world? And I think if I hadn't been in the accident, I would have just been carrying on, you know, living in New York, living my life there and not ever wondering if there was something else out there or free healthcare. Anywhere else.
It's a wonderful thing. You wanted to be an actor at that point.
So that is a big plot twist moment, is I thought that I was going to be a stage actor. I thought I was going to be in musical theater. I thought I was going to be on Broadway. You know, I had danced since I was a kid and I could sing a little bit. I was like an alto, you know, so I couldn't.
What's your go-to song?
I would love to one day play, I forget the character's name, but Patti LuPone plays her in Company.
Okay.
She did it on Broadway and here in the West End. So I love the song Ladies Who Lunch, Stephen Sondheim. That would be my go-to role, and I'll age into that one day. But for now, yeah, I'm not a great singer, but I think sometimes when you're an alto, you can sort of just like emphatically speak your way through a song. So that was my go-to. But I thought I was going to do musical theater and was going and taking dance classes in Manhattan, you know, every day. It's a 2-hour commute from where I lived in Staten Island. Yeah, so I get on the overground train. That's 40 minutes, then a half an hour ferry, and then another 40 minutes to get to Midtown on the subway or whatever it was. Yeah, so I was going in almost every day, taking dance classes and singing lessons and all this stuff, and then hit by a car and all of that just stopped.
And then you travel, you get to London, and you go into Lambda.
Yeah, then I thought, well, okay, I can't dance, but maybe I'll be like a Shakespearean actor. All of this was because I was afraid to do comedy, because comedy, I always wanted to, but
comedy was on that was on your mind.
Yeah, when
it
I was...
It wasn't a reaction to, I think, was it a year after Lambda, you couldn't seem to get like a job nailed down, and you were thinking...
Ouch. Yeah, it was.
No, but there's so many stories we've had like that of actors. Stephen Graham, I mean, brilliant actor, does a big role, and then suddenly 8 months later, he's like, I haven't got a job. What's going on? But it's just the nature of that occupation.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you think that's never going to happen to you. You know, when you're at drama school, you have people come in and speak to you, and they are all just success stories. And you don't realize it at the time, but that's actually so rare. And the majority of people who go to drama school will graduate and find themselves very unemployed afterwards.
Probably humbles people very quickly, I imagine.
Yeah. And also, it just makes you realize so much of it is about, I think, luck. Well, first of all, there's a lot of very talented people. So don't underestimate that talent isn't actually everything. You know, I think a lot of it is luck and timing. I think a lot of it is what you look like. Do you look like this character? Not necessarily are you a very, you know, attractive person. There are lots of attractive people who do acting, but you know, I found that I was kind of falling between two stools. I wasn't characterful enough looking to play the funny friend or the quirky friend in something. And I'm, you know, I'm not a great beauty, so I wasn't playing the lead in anything.
Don't put yourself down like that.
Look, I'm married. Come on, stop. So, yeah, I was really struggling, I think, to reconcile the painful reality that when you're an actor, you're just really just waiting around for someone to give you a job. You don't create anything. You just kind of are at the whim. I remember the feeling of it was that I was in like a black void and I couldn't see what was coming my way. I was just sort of hoping something was going to stick. And nothing did. So then I felt like, you know what, nothing can be worse than like bleak unemployment. So I signed up for an open mic and thought, if I get heckled off stage, at least I'll have done 5 minutes of performing.
No previous experience?
I'd never...
No classes?
I did a class.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because I was such a coward that I did... I went to the comedy school. And I think it was a 6-week course. And every Sunday for 3 hours, we'd be taught by a very unwilling teacher who obviously was dealing with his own thoughts on where his career had ended up.
He'd probably done quite a few classes, right?
Yeah, I think he'd done too many classes. Yeah. And he hated us. And we were all so nervous and so bad at comedy. And then at the end of it, there was a performance, which is...
Oh, you do it in front of each other and their friends and family,
right? You
do it
in front of each other in the classes, but then at the end, all of the classes, and there was maybe 5 different courses that were on in that 6-week period, do a big performance at Backyard Comedy Club in London. And I think 300, 200 people come, because everybody invites all their friends and family, because this will be the first and last time that most people do stand-up comedy.
Yeah, right.
I remember performing in that and being like, walking off stage and thinking, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And then promptly getting into the open mic circuit where you're not performing in front of 200 very friendly people. You're performing in front of, you know, 20 people, half of which are
quite drunk,
nervous comedians. And the other half are very drunk friends who've been, you know, dragged along. So, yeah, that was
very liberating, though, to come off that 6-week course and think, I've arrived. This is what I should be doing.
I mean, I probably had no reason to think that. I probably was just slightly better than someone who had no intention of ever being a comedian and just signed up for the class for just a laugh. But
well, here you are. We'll come on to Manoush. We're going to talk about that. I mean, quite famous in the Edinburgh Fringe, 8.5 months pregnant, and you're performing that show.
Yeah, that was a mistake. Don't do that. Yep.
So that's something that you did actually just sign up for. I mean, you'd had a lot, I think, beforehand that had led you to think, right, I'm just going to go back into work. There's a lot of emotive experiences, right?
Yeah. So I wasn't going to do The Fringe originally because I was doing a work in progress at The Fringe with my friend Huge Davies. So he would do 20 minutes and I would do 20 minutes. And we were just working up new material. And in the last week of The Fringe, or maybe 2 weeks of that Fringe in 2022, I found out that I was pregnant, which meant that I was going to be giving birth, I think, 2 or 3 months before The Fringe in 2023. And I spoke to my friend and director, Adam Brace, and he thought that was crazy. And he was right. He thought it was crazy to give birth and then take the baby up to the Edinburgh Fringe and then be trying to learn how to take care of a baby and also be dealing with the stress of the Fringe and all the financial pressure and all that. So I was felt really down because I felt like...
It's so conflicting.
Yeah. There is no parity between men and women when you're making babies. You know, it's just not fair. Women go through all of the pain and all of the setbacks, and men have their own pain and setbacks. You know, my husband kept saying, I feel really helpless in this situation.
Right.
And also he was doing a lot of caregiving at the time because I was very nauseous. I had really bad morning sickness. But when it comes down to it, it is you give up the autonomy of your own body. You're sharing your body with someone else. And it makes you really tired. It makes you sick. It makes you gain weight. It makes you nauseous and dizzy and all these things. And it isn't easy to make a baby as a woman. And as a man, all you have to do is just your favorite thing. You just do your favorite thing a bunch of times. And then eventually, 9 months later, a baby is born. So I felt really resentful, actually. And I wanted a baby, but I felt like this is so unfair. I can't believe that I have to take a step back from work when I was really excited about the stuff I was writing and I really wanted to do
a new
show.
You were very much on the rise as well in terms of your profile here, right?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I felt like I was falling behind because I had done a show in 2019 that went very well.
And, you had Best Newcomer Nominee, right?
Yeah. And then COVID happened. So it seemed like I had just become a professional comedian. The show went well. And then a few months later, there was no more stand-up comedy or there were Zoom gigs, which were, you know, just absolutely disastrous.
I can imagine.
So, yeah, so I felt like my career had taken a real step back because of COVID. And so I was really excited to do the new show and was really upset that having a baby meant I wasn't going to. And then in October, I lost that baby. And then I had all these mixed feelings about, did I wish my baby away? And, you know, am I a bad mom because I wasn't able to carry a baby to term? And all those awful thoughts, I think, that come along with having a miscarriage. And so when I got pregnant again, January 3rd, my birthday, I found out I was pregnant. I thought, I'm going to do the Fringe because I really had a feeling like I was going to lose this pregnancy as well. I think when you have a miscarriage, you just think you're going to have another miscarriage. And I didn't want to assume anything. So I thought, I don't want to put my life on hold. And if I do have another miscarriage, at least I'll have the Fringe to look forward to. And if I don't have a miscarriage, I'll be doing the Fringe at full term pregnancy, but at least I'll be pregnant. You know, I thought that would be a good idea.
Weirdly, I can understand that.
Yeah.
That logic.
Yeah. I was just tired. I was very tired.
So talk to me, how many shows did you do over the course of Fringe?
I think I
took 8.5 months pregnant.
Yeah. I think I did maybe 26 shows.
Oh my God.
But you know what? Listen. People go and work in offices. I met
That's
a producer
true.
Who's on her feet running around, TV producer, doing a TV series, and she was 8.5 months pregnant. And that was like 8-9 hour days. I was doing a 50-minute show once a day, and I was complaining the whole time. And my husband was like driving me in. I got a parking space at the Fringe, and then he would drive me home. So, yeah, I was tired, but people do way more when they're that pregnant. So I really have nothing to complain about.
Wow. What was the best heckle, actually? Did you get a good heckle?
You know, come on. People don't really heckle. They're impressed that you're just standing up at 9 months pregnant.
I mean, there is something comedic about it, right?
People were very lovely while I was pregnant. It's really fun to do stand-up when you're pregnant because I think there's just an image that people have in their head that pregnant women are these sort of almost non-human, like angelic figures that are in love with their baby and are, you know, the embodiment of maternity. And really to be up there and talking about my husband's jizz was very freeing.
You're quite savvy at social media. How much of the those clips and what you say in stand-up is true versus exaggerated? So like your dad with being sent in certain magazines, for example.
He still gets them. Yeah. Yeah, he sent me a picture of bunch of gay porn that I got in the mail the other day.
So, for context, he does an article.
He wrote an article.
Yeah, for a local newspaper.
Honestly, 20 years ago in our local newspaper, where he, you know, voiced his opinion I don't agree with, about how he thinks that same-sex couples should have the right to have a civil union, but the term marriage can only be used to describe a man and a woman because it has religious connotations and whatever, whatever. And in retaliation, my father was unwittingly sent dozens and dozens of gay porn magazines. And they still come to the house. And it is the funniest thing because he has to call up and cancel the subscriptions. You know, people are signing him up for it. So they come addressed to him.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's great because our mailman sees it. Oh, it's very good. Very funny.
Well done. 20 years later.
Well done, gays.
Yeah, well, that is amazing. That is so, so good.
Yeah.
What's your relationship like with your dad? Because correct me if I'm wrong, seems a little bit more conservative perhaps than you are.
Yeah, he's just slightly more conservative than I am. So my first show talked a lot about having, you know, an ultra-conservative dad, Republican father, and being a very liberal person myself. And my dad voted for Donald Trump and still will vote for him again. It looks like he'll be the nominee, and my dad is very much Trump 2024. And so I thought that no one would relate to the show because in the UK, because Trump is so alien to the British public. There's very few people, I think he's a pretty switched on guy. But when I did the show, loads of people came up to me afterwards to say that their parents voted for Brexit, or the referendums had just happened in Ireland. You know, they had those two referendums where they voted to legalize gay marriage and abortion. And so I had a lot of Irish people come up to me and say that their parents voted the opposite of them in those referendums. And so I realized then that there is a sort of universality in the specific idea that, of, you know, having a parent who you love, who is a good parent, who has, you know, on paper, if someone told me what my dad was like, I would have just thought, well, this isn't someone that I would ever relate to. And yet he's my dad and I love him. And, you know, it's complicated.
So, do you talk about those sort of things? Do you ever try and have a little bit of a debate there?
Sometimes, but it never goes anywhere. You know, politics, it seems, and I'm very dumb, I don't know much about it, but it seems like it's less about facts and more about faith. And you can't use facts to argue faith with people. Daniel Kitson had a line in one of his shows where he said, just because your team loses a game doesn't mean you support the other team. You know, you still root for your team. So if you're in a debate with someone and you make all these points, they're not going to suddenly become a Democrat just because you've made a bunch of points and sort of, you know, defeated their argument. It just doesn't work like that. People are so ingrained in what they believe in. And yeah, it's like talking to a wall. But I think my dad would probably say the same thing if he was on this podcast, that he thinks talking to me is like talking to a wall.
Yeah. Going back to your comedy, where you find your content, your inspiration, is there a creative process in terms of how you think this will work? And how do you start that off? You've got like a new show coming up and you think, right, I'm going to, maybe there's old material you can use, but I want to focus on some new material. What's the process like in terms of finding that content?
I think it's sort of just either things that happen in my life. I happen to surround myself accidentally with ridiculous characters like my family and friends. So it's either just things that happen that I think, oh, that's really funny, and I write that down and sort of start shaping that into something, or just ideas that I have. There's no real process. I have no process. I just sort of...
I mean, your husband's a comedian, which probably helps, right, in terms of bouncing off ideas?
Yeah, he's really good. He's really good at, if there's something that I'm circling and I'm like, sometimes this bit works and sometimes it doesn't, and I can't figure out why, he's really good at listening to it and being like, oh, well, you're not being very clear about this. You know, maybe if you put that here or move the premise more here.
Emphasis, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to talk to someone who has an outside eye in that way.
That is nice.
Yeah.
Let's do another plot twist question.
Okay.
Plot twist person. So an unexpected source of inspiration that perhaps, other than family and friends, you might not have foreseen, maybe? Is there anyone that stands out?
Big time, yeah. So I started doing comedy in very late 2016, I think. And I think a year after I started, I did the Leicester Square New Comedian competition and just absolutely ate it. I was really bad. And it's not because the material was bad. A lot of that same material that was terribly reviewed, shout out Steve Bennett, ouch, I later then used in my show, but I just didn't know how to perform it well, how to structure it in a way that came off charming. You know, it's very hard to only have 5 minutes and be able to impress upon an audience what your voice is and who you are as a person. So I did really badly, and that was December 2017. And then a year after that, I signed up for the Soho Young Company. So it's a stand-up comedy course. And while I was doing that, I was slowly starting to figure out a bit of my voice and how to do stand-up. And while I was on that course, this guy came in named Adam Brace, and he, first off, was so hungover when he came in. Very well-dressed man, you know, like beautifully pressed button-up shirt, like cool Doc Martens, like looked very well put together. Came in, sat down, and then just leaned over to the other teacher and just went, "Do I seem hungover?" And straight away I was like, this guy doesn't care about us. You know, he's an hour late. Anyway, I got up. We had to all perform our 3 minutes in front of him. He and I had a big argument about a bit that I said would work and he said wouldn't. And then he said, "You know, I like you because you're not scared of me." And I was like, who does this guy think he is? Why would I be scared of anyone? And then after that class, I found out who he was. And I was like, I should have been very scared of that man. He directed some of the most beautiful shows that I had seen at the Edinburgh Fringe. He directed Alex Edelman's Just For Us, which has just finished a run on Broadway. And he directed Alfie Brown's Lunatic, which is a stunning show that absolutely should have been nominated for Best Show, but he was snubbed. And I'd never seen stand-up comedy that was that funny and also had so much heart and impact. And I couldn't believe that those two things could be married together.
Mm, that's rare.
So rare. It's so hard. I think a lot of comedians complain about, you know, they call it like the dead grandma show, where there are some comics that come out and try and just sprinkle on a bit of pathos to a pretty weak, structured, not very funny show and say, and then, you know, my grandma died, and they hope that people will.
Emotive.
Yeah, it will bring out some, you know, emotion from the audience or whatever. But these two were shows that had so beautifully blended and tied together these, like, in Alfie's show, very, like, deep, dark themes, you know, with very, very funny, charming comedy. And Alex Edelman's show is so heavy. It's about Alex, who is Jewish, who went to a neo-Nazi, like, get-together, you know?
Blimey.
Yeah, so they have really serious, very dark themes in them, but we're all just so perfectly, perfectly executed. And after I found out who Adam was and what he directed, I kind of like hung my head, sent him an email. And I just said, I actually saw your shows at the Edinburgh Fringe and thought they were amazing. And, you know, here's my idea for my, I was doing my first hour at that Fringe. I sent him a paragraph of what I thought I was going to write about how my dad was a Trump supporter and the son of Arab immigrants and how I struggled to reconcile with that and how we would butt heads all the time. And I emailed him, and then he emailed me back and said, I was actually going to email you. I enjoyed working with you, which I thought was so strange because I had a fight. He claimed afterwards that he didn't think we had a fight, but, you know, we definitely did.
But he obviously saw something in you.
Maybe, yeah. Yeah, I think he likes people who stand their ground, you know.
Have conviction, believe in what they're doing.
Yeah, because I think he is that to the nth degree. I think then it was Christmas break. I won this comedy competition called The Laughing Horse, which I did not think I was going to win at all. And I think then my career started to sort of, you know, I was kind of slowly climbing my way out of the open mic circuit. And Adam got on board to direct the show and was just a champion of, like, a lot of people email Adam to try and work with them. And he takes on very few people because he puts his whole heart into working with an act. He got Soho Theatre to agree to produce my show. I had done nothing before then. You know, I was no one.
It was a big jump.
Huge jump. And I also think he was very worried that it wouldn't go well, because I think he really stuck his neck out for me on that. And, you know, things like, what do I wear on stage? He'd help me with that. You know, he'd help me with, obviously, the structure and the narrative of it all. He would come and watch me do 10-minute spots at clubs and give me notes on it. I would send him every set I ever did. I'd record them on my phone and send them to him, and he would come back with notes and encouragement. And he was unbelievable. And he truly showed me the path that I needed to be taking in my career and held my hand and walked me down it. And that show that we wrote together ended up getting nominated for the Best Newcomer at the Fringe, which means nothing to the general public, but as a comedian, it's...
That's a big thing.
Does it?
Yeah.
But as a comedian, it means so much. And
I think it creates an excitement, actually, hearing that.
Right, right.
Someone's breaking through, and who's, you know, what's he or she going to be?
I think there's something cool in that. Right, right. That you're on the sort of precipice of someone who could be big.
Yeah.
I see. Yeah, yeah. Hasn't happened for me yet, but let's see.
Hey.
So.
I feel like, I was just thinking a minute ago, I feel like you've become very British, like very humble. Don't like to brag.
Listen.
Be American. Just shout about what you're
doing.
It's
a New York.
You're great.
I really think there's a lot of commonality between New Yorkers and the UK, because New Yorkers, there's this thing where I'm from in Staten Island. People say, oh, he thinks who he is. You know, that sentence makes no sense structurally, but you know what it means. It means don't get too big for your boots, you know.
Right.
So I've definitely grown up with that voice in my head. And also the way that, oh, I know, I love it so much. I hated it when I was growing up. And now whenever I go home, my husband, who's Irish, is always like, this is insane. It's like we're in The Sopranos. For my brother's wedding, I was one of the groomsmen and I had to wear a suit. So I went to this like suit rental place and rented straight up like a boy's communion tux. Like that's what I was wearing. And the guy who was adjusting me was talking to my husband and my dad. And my dad was, oh God, it's so funny on Staten Island. My dad is a high school teacher there of the all-boys Catholic school and gets a discount on everything because everybody sends their boys to the school.
Right.
So he's always like, oh, Callahan, I feel like I had your son, Eric Callahan. And then immediately it's like 25% off. So my dad was doing that to this very Italian man who was measuring my suit. And then the guy was like, all right, yeah, you know what? Half price. You know, my son said you were a great teacher, whatever. And then my dad was like, oh, thanks so much. And the guy went, ah, forget about it. And my husband, it was like his head exploded. He just went, did you actually just say forget about it? And he said that as an Irish man, it was like someone saying top of the morning. Like he was like, I didn't think people actually said that. And the guy was so funny. He was just like, yeah, forget about it. It means don't worry about it unless there's a problem. And then forget about it. It means worry about it.
Oh, it really is The Sopranos. I love it.
It's crazy, yeah.
So back to Adam, because he seems like the ultimate mentor, really, at that point, to give so much time like
hugely.
That. It feels quite rare.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was amazing. So plot twist, he... almost a year ago today, died. He had a stroke. I was texting him in the morning, and then a few hours later, we were making plans, we were writing the new show. A few hours later, we made a plan to meet on the Friday, and a few hours later, his partner, Becca, texted me and said, Adam can't meet you on Friday, he's in the hospital, he had a stroke. And then 2 days later, he had another stroke, and then they put him into a medically induced coma, and he ended up dying a month later of complications of that.
No, I'm so sorry. That's such a shock.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we're still dealing with it. Like, it's just, I'd never lost someone and lost someone in such a unexpected way where 1 minute I'm texting him about my stupid problems. You know, I can't figure out the end of the show. I don't know what to do. And he's encouraging me. And then, you know, the next minute, that's it. That's the last conversation I'll ever have with him. Yeah, he was 43, which is...
I mean, that's nothing.
No age, I know. Yeah, so he was just the best. And without him, I definitely wouldn't be a comedian. I think I would have given up. And if I was a comedian, I definitely wouldn't be attempting to make shows that have any sort of heart in them. I would just be probably telling dick jokes, I imagine.
has that period influenced the work that went into Minouche and future shows in terms of that emotive? Because I mean, that whole period of your life actually is quite, it's quite traumatic in some ways.
Yeah, I think, yeah, so it was...
Well, very much so, actually, not in some ways. It is very much traumatic.
Yeah, we lost the baby in October, and then we lost Adam in the end of April. So, yeah, it was dark times. And to be writing a show at the time, a comedy show, and having to perform that every night, I realized while I was on stage telling jokes that I didn't feel very funny and I didn't actually want to be talking about the stuff I was talking about. And it became very clear that I should be talking about Adam and talking about the miscarriage. And so the show that I was writing with Adam then became a show about Adam and losing him. Yeah. Yeah. And that's been, on one hand, very cathartic, but then on the other hand, also hard to do, because now that I'm touring, I'll be on a train going up to do a show, and I'm thinking to myself, okay, well, later tonight I'm just going to be recounting the death of a very good friend of mine. So yeah, it's
very
been
real.
It's been a real mix, but I think in the end it kind of feels like, you know, when you have a muscle ache and it's always there, just like a dull pain.
I do, actually. Yeah.
And so when you kind of like, you know, dig your thumbs in, it hurts, but it actually feels good. Mm. That's, I think, how it feels to be grieving someone. It's, you have a constant dull pain, and then talking about them, even though it's painful and reminds you of what you're going through, also offers you some relief, you know?
Yeah. You talked about this sort of emotion with comedy, and actually that being quite rare. I've got this thing where, tell me what you think as well. I find that from a creative process, I find that whole thing interesting, because I like to think of myself as a creative person. But sometimes with comedy, it feels like some people will go to the extremes, as in they'll try and find something that is very provocative, something that is quite shocking.
Edgy. Right, right, yeah.
And you know that's going to elicit some form of reaction from the audience.
Right, right.
And yeah, creatively, that just feels a bit lazy.
Right. I think it's so weird with comedy how it's just one category, when actually it's more like, you would never say, I went and saw an action movie and then I saw a rom-com, and only action movies are movies. You know, rom-coms are something different. They're all movies. You know, there are people who like edgy comedy and that's their thing, and they like to hear that and, you know, watch someone dance on that line. And when someone does that really well, it's amazing to watch. I think, unfortunately, a lot of people do it quite clumsily and then are like, oh, it's free speech. And you're like, is it? But there should be a world where you can go and watch whatever type of comedy that you want without people saying that's comedy and that's not comedy. There's a huge school of comedians who think putting anything sad into a show no longer makes it a comedy show. And I just think, well, that's not true. Comedy exists as the tonic to life's pains. So why wouldn't you include that in a show? And if anything, Adam taught me that having something with a bit of gravitas in your show only helps to make the comedy more impactful, because the audience experienced that relief from the, yeah, you know, pain and sorrow that you're talking about on stage.
And maybe a relatability.
Hugely relatable and incredibly cathartic. Isn't it cathartic to sit in a dark room with a bunch of strangers and find yourself laughing at the same thing? Because laughter is...
It's infectious.
It's infectious, but it's not... You're not consciously doing it. It just happens. Mm. And so to be spontaneously laughing at something and seeing that someone else is laughing at it, there's a relatability there where you think, well, I'm not alone, or that thing, that weird thing that I thought or experienced, someone else has gone through that. And I can see that here because this whole room is laughing. And so, yeah, not to sound, you know, like comedy is, you know, it is also a lot of, you know, farting jokes too. But
you need a balance, you need a mix.
But I think there can be and should be a very wide breadth of what is considered stand-up comedy. And it's a shame that people have very narrow views of it. Yeah. I remember I did a competition once And someone came up to, it was me and Sophie Duker. We were standing at the bar and somebody who was in the audience came up and said, I really liked what you girls did. You know, it wasn't like that other comedian just talking about her vagina the whole time. And Sophie Duker, who is the most confident human being I've ever met, just turned around and went, well, if I could talk about my vagina with the amount of charm and charisma that she did, I'd be talking about it all the time. And then just turned back around. And I thought, whoa. Right. She's right. It's not for you, but, you know, it was for a lot of people in that room because a lot of people were laughing at those vagina jokes.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Yeah.
There's a mixture. We talked about acting at the beginning. Are you doing a little bit more of that? Are you looking at that as an option or is it more just sticking with the comedy for now?
I heard Maisie Adams on this podcast. Sorry, Maisie. And she was talking about how tough it is as an actor because you don't generate any of your own work. And I found that so relatable. So I still do acting and I'm filming something just before I go to India, actually, which is why we've cut the India trip slightly short. But I
more work.
Enjoy doing that alongside creating my own stuff. You know, I think for me to have a happy career, I envision it like, you know, a ship with loads of rowers. You know, sometimes you're just manning an oar in someone else's ship and sometimes you're the captain. And I think having the ability to go between those two things as, you know, a stand-up, writing your own stuff, producing your own stuff, getting out there in front of an audience of people who found you on Instagram versus being in someone else's project and saying their lines the way that they want to and wearing what they tell you to wear and standing where they tell you to stand. They both have positive and negative aspects and frustrations, and they're kind of a tonic to each other. So it's good to be able to do both because I get a big relief from turning up to a job and it's not my responsibility if the project is successful and they pay me regardless. But then at the same time, I like doing stand-up where I am responsible for selling all the tickets and, you know, making sure the content is good and I've written all the words. But at the same time, I'm also very stressed about, you know, it going well and people having a good time. You know, I want to make sure that they enjoy that. But I also enjoy creating my own work. So, yeah, it's good to have a balance.
I've mentioned that the last few years, starting like 2019 with Best Newcomer, there's been on this rise, right? And obviously COVID's impacted that. And then you've come back again. It's going in this upward trajectory. Do you think about where you want to go and what you want to do? Do you have aspirations in terms of certain gigs you'd like to play? Or do you think about, you're nodding?
I used to think that way. And then I had a baby. And now I am just, I just want to do things that make me happy. I don't want to worry. I think it's so easy. And I've heard so many comedians who, I was just talking to a friend of mine, much more successful than I am. And she is so worried that like acting work has dried up for her and she's aging and is she going to age out of the stuff that she plays and all this. And I would look at her career and think, wow, if I was in your position, I'd feel very comfortable in my career. And I think there's no satisfaction ever. No one ever feels comfortable. Everybody is constantly worried that they won't get a job, that their next job will be their last job, that I think I want to try. And I don't know how successful I'll be, but just be present and happy in the things that I'm doing now and actually move forward in my career, looking at where I've come from rather than where I'm going, because the goalpost is constantly moving. You never really reach where you think you want to reach, because once you climb one mountain, you realize it's the bottom of another mountain. Yeah. And I would rather be looking back and going, oh, look how far I've come. You know, I remember when my goal was just to be able to not have to bring someone with me to perform 5 minutes of comedy, you know, and now I get to do hour-long shows to people who have paid to come and see me specifically. And to me, that's a pretty cool thing. Mm. Yeah. So I'm trying not to have huge goals.
And I guess you have different priorities with, you know, small baby and...
Yeah, yeah, I don't want to be wishing my life away and resenting the fact that I have a little person to look after. I want to be enjoying being a mom and be present with my son and not feel this feeling of constant worry that I'm never going to get another job again. I want to just be present with my son when I'm with him and then go and do work and be present there and then come home to my son, you know?
I like that.
I thought if I can do that, that would be great, but I imagine I won't. It's very hard to do.
So you just mentioned that you're doing 60-minute sets, going from like 5 minutes and 15 and so on. Is there a particular story or segment in that 60 minutes that is your favorite to perform to an audience?
Okay, this is so weird. The show that I'm doing, it talks about my grandmother, who is a singer who kind of put her career to the back burner while she became a mom. And I talk about losing a baby, and I talk about losing a friend who was like a father figure to me. But my favorite part of the show has nothing to do with any of those things. Every night, it is a joy to perform it. I talk about the time when I almost jerked my dog off. And
what?
It was entirely medical. My dog gets these erections all the time. And I looked it up because they don't go away. They last for like hours.
It's like a Viagra.
He's a real legend. Yeah. And I looked it up, and it's actually dangerous for your dog to have erections for that long. So you have to make this paste out of sugar and water and put that on the penis, because the sugar is like a vasoconstrictor and it makes the erection subside. I'm not really selling my comedy here, am I?
No, you really are. But I'm just intrigued by this. As well.
And I'll tell you what, I do that every night, and I tell this whole story about how it happened and my husband's reaction to it.
And you're still doing it?
Call a vet. Oh, all the time. And it's so absurd, but every show someone DMs me and goes, I have to do that sugar thing with my dog too. Because it is the vet recommended thing that you're actually supposed to do if you have a dog that has these long lasting erections. I wouldn't say it was common, but it's not.
But it's not irregular.
It's not weird. And that's important that we all know that. It's not weird. It's normal.
Yeah.
I once had a veterinary nurse in, and she was like, that's what you do. So it's not weird.
And there's no medication that it takes otherwise to try and keep things down?
I don't know. I guess the sugar thing is fine and it's natural. And now I think actually he expects it. So.
I wasn't expecting that, but it's been a joy to have you on this podcast.
Thank
you so much. Good luck with what's coming up. Is there anything else you want to plug that's coming up? That's any shows? I mean, obviously, there's India coming up and Bristol tomorrow night, but any other shows that we can talk about?
I have a few things that are coming out that I don't think I'm allowed to say yet, but follow me on Instagram. Follow me on Instagram. That would be great.
Is it a TV special?
It's I'm not allowed to say.
No, on that note, thanks, Janine.
Thank you.
Janine Haruni, she was down to earth, she was humble, but my goodness, she was courageous and resilient, even being very open about the trials and tribulations in her story, moments that have impacted her and where she is today. But, you know, the car crash, the miscarriage, the loss of a friend and mentor Adam helped her to get to where she is. She is such an inspiration. And she's also a workaholic. She does not stop. Back from India, she's now off to the US and Canada. And for all UK listeners, she will be back at some point doing shows in the UK. Go and check her out on her socials and her hit show, Manouche. It's thoroughly worth it. Big thank you to Janine. And next week, the comedy continues. Neesh Kumar, Josh Widdicombe, podcast royalty. That's a bit scary. Looking forward to that. But that's all from me. So until then, ciao, guys.